creating de facto wilderness areas. The law gives that power only to Congress, not the executive branch. Environmentalists say the legal battle over the roadless rule is not finished. They plan to appeal Judge Brimmer's decision. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
The Navy has fired the commander of a Fleet Air Reconnaissance Squadron that provides airborne communications for the President and the Defense Secretary as they control command of nuclear forces, including submarines, bombers, and missile silos. Commander Sean Bentley has been relieved of command 3 months after taking charge of Squadron 3. In a statement that gave no further details, Bentley's superior said he'd lost confidence in Bentley's ability to command. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Have a question about digital radio or digital TV? Come to the WILL Digital Information Fair and Open House Sunday, August 24th from 2 to 4:30 at 300 North Goodwin, Urbana. Get your questions answered, tour Campbell Hall, meet our on-air hosts, and enter to win a digital TV or digital radio. We hope to see you Sunday, August 24th at Campbell Hall.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Well, I have to start off by saying that when I promoted the subjects for this morning's program just before the news, I'm afraid I got them wrong way around. So just to be clear here, that the program that I mentioned talking about the subprime lending crisis, that will be our number two. That'll be our 11 o'clock hour. So in this first part of the program, we'll be talking about Cuba and recent events in Cuba. In February this past year, Raul Castro officially took over as president of Cuba, succeeding his brother, Fidel, who had led the country for almost 50 years. Many people have said that it looked as if Raul's commitment to the values of the revolution might even be stronger than his brother's. However, there are other people who think that Raul could be the one to push the country toward capitalism. We'll talk about that and other things this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Professor William Leo Grand. He is the dean of the School of Public Affairs at American University in Washington, D.C. He is a specialist in Latin American politics and in U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America. He has authored 5 books, the latest of which is Our Own Backyard, the United States in Central America, 1977 to 1992. Previously, he served on the staffs of the Democratic Policy Committee of the U.S. Senate and the Democratic Caucus Task Force on Central America of the U.S. House of Representatives. He's joining us this morning by telephone. And as we talk, of course, questions and comments are welcome. They always are. The only thing, however, we ask of people who are calling into the show is that they try to keep their comments and questions brief so we can get in as many different callers as possible and keep our program moving along. But, of course, anybody who is listening is welcome to join us. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So here in, again, in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. At any point here, questions are certainly welcome. Professor Leo Grand, hello.
Hello.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
For a long time, people who particularly followed Cuba were certainly aware of Raul Castro. They knew who he was. But at the same time, the person who always was the public face of the government, who always represented the country to the outside world, was Fidel Castro. And at the same time, I think a lot of people expected that when that point came that Fidel Castro could no longer lead the country, that his brother would take over. But having said all that, it seemed that at the point where we really made this transition, first he was the acting president, then he officially became president, there were a lot of people who were saying, well, who is this man? And what sort of leader is he likely to be? So maybe I could ask you to start at that point and talk about Raul Castro and who he is.
Sure. He's never been a very public person, and in fact, in the first interview he gave after Fidel fell ill, he said quite explicitly that he didn't really enjoy the public spotlight, and he didn't intend to change his ways, which made some people think that he maybe didn't quite understand the importance of symbolic politics when you're president instead of vice president. But subsequently, he's actually given quite a number of public speeches, and he seems to have adapted to the new role. His strength and what he contributed to the Cuban regime was organizational skill. It's not a coincidence that Fidel put him in charge of the armed forces, which, given Cuba's relationship with the United States, the armed forces was seen as a real linchpin for the security of the revolution. And he did a good job. There is no doubt that the armed forces is the best organized, most efficient institution in the country, and probably has been since the early 1960s. Raul is also very pragmatic. Over the years, even before the collapse of the Soviet Union, he was always more willing to experiment with market mechanisms in the economy than Fidel. Now, that's not to say he's a capitalist. He's not. He actually was a communist before Fidel was a communist. He was a member of the communist youth when he was a youngster in the 1950s. So he is a dedicated communist, but he's a pragmatic one, more like Deng Xiaoping in China than like Mao Zedong. He believes in getting things right, doing things efficiently, and he's willing to experiment in order to achieve that. To give you an example, at the height, or I should say the depth, of Cuba's economic crisis after the Soviet Union collapsed, 1992, 1993, Raul Castro insisted that Fidel allow private farmers in Cuba to sell their produce in free markets as opposed to forcing them to sell to the government. That would give them better prices, it would stimulate agricultural production and make food more available. And there were food shortages in those days. Fidel resisted it, he didn't want to do it. He had closed such farmers' markets in the 1980s, but Raul convinced him that, as Raul said, food or bread was more important than cannons. And Fidel finally relented, and they created the farmers' markets, which continue to exist and have, in fact, boosted food production.
Hmm. What do we know about the health of Fidel Castro and what his daily life is like?
Well, all we really know about his health is what we're able to glean from the occasional videotapes that they release. And it's clear that he came very close to death on at least several occasions. He had three different emergency operations. And in some of those early tapes that we saw at the end of 2006, beginning of 2007, he looked astonishingly feeble. I was surprised, actually, that they released the tapes. He looked so bad. But I think they were trying to convince people he had not already died, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Now, over the last 2 years, he's gradually been getting stronger. And now when you see him meeting foreign dignitaries, which he does fairly regularly, he looks a lot like his old self. He looks robust. His voice is strong. He's animated. He's energetic. His daily life seems to be focused mainly on reading and writing op-ed pieces. He's become Cuba's number one op-ed writer, producing what are called Reflections of the Comandante, and are published in the newspaper every couple of days. So in the last 2 years, he's published dozens and dozens of these reflections. Most of the time, they focus on international events rather than domestic ones. Occasionally, he'll write something about the domestic situation, but mostly it's reflections on foreign affairs.
Mm. Clearly, what he says continues to matter to people of Cuba. Is there, but it sounds as if he truly is not involved in the day-to-day running of the country, but then one still wonders, well, if he decides something should happen or if there might be some sort of disagreement on policy between him and his brother and the other people who are running the government, whose opinion carries the most weight?
Well, Raul is very careful to say publicly, and he said this on several occasions, that he consults with Fidel on every major decision, both domestic and international, and on several occasions when he's introduced some new reform measures, he's been careful to say that he showed Fidel the draft of his speech and Fidel approved it in advance.
You gave one example of a place where Raul argued for a kind of an economic reform that initially his brother opposed and then changed his mind. And I think this is one of those areas in which there's been a lot of attention to what he has done. People have asked the question, well, what might be the future direction of Cuba's economy? How might things change now that Raul is president? And people, and as I said in my introduction, I think people have gone as far as to suggest, as you say, not that Cuba's going to become a capitalist country or that is a capitalism, but that he would his approach to economics would be perhaps more like the Chinese, and that it would be nudging it in a capitalist direction, but not a full-fledged capitalist economy. Now, during the time, say, over the last year or so, has there been anything that he has done or said that would offer more clues about his the way that he thinks about economic policy?
Yes, there have been a number of things. One of the very first things he did was to pay off a debt that the state had to small private farmers. Private farmers sell part of their produce to the government for distribution through the state system, and they're allowed to sell part of it on the free market. Well, the government owed them millions of pesos that it hadn't paid them for the produce they had delivered to the state. So one of the first things he did was to pay that debt to the small farmers in order to, again, stimulate their production. He gave a speech in June of this year in which he talked about the fact that a large amount of state-owned agricultural land was not being cultivated. And he put forward a draft law, which the National Assembly approved, to turn the use of that land over to private farmers in order to get it back into production. Even in the state sector of agriculture, they've taken a number of state farms and cooperative farms and turned them into, they're still technically cooperatives, but they've given out use of the land to families. And so they've almost in de facto privatized a significant part of agriculture. I think this is all very parallel to the early stages of the Chinese reform, which was to incentivize farmers to produce more and then to use their increased production as an engine of economic development.
Mm-hmm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is William Leo Grand. He's Dean of the School of Public Affairs at American University, Washington, D.C. He's a specialist in Latin American politics and also in U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America. And we're talking about Cuba. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You made reference to the crisis in the Cuban economy that came after the Soviet Union came apart, and that Cuba no longer had the kind of economic support that the Soviet Union had provided, and that was no doubt very, very difficult for the country. What is the official state of relations today between Cuba and Russia?
Well, it's correct. I wouldn't say it's all that friendly, but it's not hostile either. Initially, when Boris Yeltsin was president of Russia, the relationship was very bad. It was Yeltsin that had cut off economic assistance to Cuba and really had an ideological aversion to the Cubans. Since Yeltsin left and Putin became president and now prime minister, the relationship has improved at the political level. At the commercial level, it's continued to be strong. Cuba still sells a fair amount of its sugar production and other raw materials to Russia in exchange for a variety of manufactured goods. I think Russia is one of the top three or four trading partners of Cuba today.
And let's talk about the relationship between Cuba and the United States. And if you set aside for the moment the official relationship or lack of official relationship between the two governments, if you look at other kinds of connections between Cuba and the United States, or perhaps between the people of Cuba and the people of the United States, in what ways do ties persist? And in fact, there may be strong ties below the level of official recognition?
Well, the strongest people-to-people ties are between Cuban Americans who live in the United States and have maintained connection to their families back on the island. About 100,000 Cuban Americans were traveling to Cuba every year a few years ago until President Bush tightened up those restrictions and limited Cubans to one visit every 3 years to visit family members. Cuban Americans send over $1 billion in remittances to family members on the island, and that's just cash. That doesn't count the goods that they take with them when they go to visit. So that tie is extremely important. The other big tie right now is actually a commercial one. Despite the fact that we have an embargo against Cuba, it is legal to sell food and medicine to the island. Congress approved the sale of food and medicine back in the year 2000 as a humanitarian measure. And we, the United States, is Cuba's, I think, sixth largest trading partner as a consequence of the sale of food and medicine every year.
We have a caller here to bring in the conversation. I want to do that and perhaps also give our telephone number again. Anybody is welcome to join in. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So calls are welcome. We'll start out here with someone here where we are in Champaign County, and this is line one. Hello?
Hi. Just one little short thing. The U.K. was the biggest trading partner in the past. Is the Burton Act and the restrictions on shipping push somebody else to the top, or are they, or is the U.K. still the largest single trading partner? Bye.
No, actually, today, the largest trading partner with Cuba is Canada.
Oh.
European countries follow that, I think. And it's either Spain or Italy, I think, follows that, then probably the UK after that. And also one has to distinguish between commodities trade and tourism. The largest tourist sources for the Cuban tourism industry are first Canada, then Italy, Spain, and then some of the other European countries. But Cuba has been pretty successful in diversifying its trade relations. Back in the late 1980s, they were doing about 85% of their trade with the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe. So when the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe abandoned communism and became market economies and stopped giving Cuba preferential trade, the Cubans really had to totally reorient their international economic relations, and they focused primarily on the European Union countries.
So Canada is probably higher because of the amount of tourism? Or you're saying
I think Canada is high because Canada has a lot of investments in the Cuban nickel industry, mm-hmm. which, particularly given recent commodity prices, is a very big part of Cuba's commodity trade.
You've mentioned Fidel as an analyst in the press. He was extremely prescient about ethanol. In fact, he dissuaded Chavez from throwing his weight into ethanol production in a big way because he saw it as part of the food crisis. The Cubans also, apparently, in their agricultural system, because they were isolated in this fashion, had to do less with more and consequently had less of the petroleum inputs and were sort of somewhat isolated from that. Now, I don't know how you react to that, but what I wanted to ask about was the U.S. relations on a bigger picture, sort of the propaganda kind of... there was a kerfuffle just a bit ago about Cheney repeating something that George Will got from somebody who, I don't know if we ever found out, who misinformed George Will that China was helping develop oil offshore in Cuba. I think the Spanish are, if I ever recollect. But just the whole idea of that kind of scaremongering, not that the Monroe Doctrine is still in effect or anything, but you're in D.C., so, I mean, what kind of reaction do people have to that? I mean, it was debunked fairly quickly.
Well, it's an election year, you know, and Cuba tends to become a hot issue in election years because of the importance of the Cuban-American community in South Florida. And if you go back, some of the worst crises in U.S.-Cuban relations have actually come about in U.S. election years. I think the mistake about China drilling offshore of Cuba came about because just recently the Cubans appear to have discovered at least potentially very significant petroleum deposits in part of the Caribbean that Cuba owns the drilling rights to. And they have been leasing exploration rights to a large number of international petroleum companies, some from China, Venezuela, Malaysia, I think Canada has some. So there's a number of foreign corporations that have purchased the right to explore in that area and see what they can find. But they haven't found anything yet. They haven't found major deposits yet, and the Chinese have not actually been drilling, which was the accusation that was made in the U.S. press. You know, it's because it's an election year, certain commentators, you know, take the opportunity to take a shot at Cuba whenever they can.
Mm. Well, I'm recollecting that during the anthrax scare, there was a story about some bio weaponry research institute, and that was shopped around, and it did get some purchase. It turns out it is a biotechnology institute, and there's actually some scientists here in the U of I community, not in the center of things, but on the margins, who actually work with some people that are there, and it's right out in the open. It's a $1 billion investment on their part, the Cubans' part. But it's not demonstrably anything to do with...
Yeah, this was a big flap back in 2002, right on the eve of former President Jimmy Carter's trip to Cuba. An official in the Bush administration accused the Cubans of trying to develop biological weapons. In fact, the Cubans, as you say, have invested a lot of money in biotechnology and have developed a number of vaccines that they sell primarily in the third world. And the Cubans offered right away to allow international inspection of their facilities to demonstrate that they were not involved in weapons development. That flap blew over when a closer look at the intelligence suggested that, in fact, there really wasn't much evidence there.
All right. We're getting close to our midpoint here in this part of Focus 580. We're talking about Cuba. And again, our guest for this hour is William Leogrand. He is Dean of the School of Public Affairs at American University, Washington, D.C. He's a specialist in Latin American politics and in U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free 800-222-9455. As you've said, and I'm sure people know, for a long time, policy, U.S., official U.S. government policy toward Cuba has been very heavily influenced by Cuban Americans living in South Florida that are identify very solidly with the Republican Party and have taken a very hard line on relations between Cuba and the United States. I think maybe in some way, I'm not sure how big a way, and you can say how big, that maybe has begun to change with the demographics as the demographics of the Cuban American community changes, and we have now generations of people who were born in the United States, who have no memory of living in Cuba, no memory of the revolution, that have maybe a slightly more pragmatic approach to their relationship. And I'm interested in how in the role that Cuban Americans play in helping to set U.S. government policy toward Cuba, and perhaps how that may be changing.
Well, it is changing. And, you know, in the 1980s, when Cuban Americans, large numbers of them were becoming citizens, those who left in the 60s and even in the 70s were becoming citizens, and they began to, you know, they're one-issue voters, by and large. They vote based on where a politician stands on the issue of Cuba, and consequently they were overwhelmingly Republican and still are predominantly Republican in terms of their party identification. They had a tremendous influence simply because Florida is always a swing state in presidential elections, and they constitute for 3, 4, 5% of the voting population in Florida, and they vote on this issue. So, you know, winning the Cuban American vote can be the difference between winning the presidency and not. I think there's no doubt that Cuban American anger over the fact that Bill Clinton sent Elian Gonzalez, the little 6-year-old boy, back to his father in Cuba, was the reason that Al Gore got a very small percentage of Cuban American voters and lost the 2000 election.
Mm.
Now, what's happened in recent years, though, is very interesting. We have a whole series of opinion polls that have been done among the Cuban-American community by Florida International University, dating all the way back to the early 1990s, and it's shown gradually a moderation of the community's attitudes about relations with Cuba. And it's very clearly correlated to generations. Not only just the generations of people born here or born in Cuba, but the generations of when people came. So people who came in the 1960s came because they were politically disaffected. They politically were opposed to the communist direction that Fidel Castro took the revolution. Those people cut off all ties to the island. They regarded as anybody who stayed as being a Fidel sympathizer, and they have always had the most recalcitrant, hardest line attitude about any kind of relationship with the island. But people who came really starting in about 1980 with the Mariel boat lift at the tail end of Jimmy Carter's administration, all the way up through the 1994 rafters crisis during the Clinton administration, those people came as much for economic reasons as for political ones. And like people coming from other countries in Latin America, they came looking for a better life. They did not cut off ties with their families back on the island. In fact, they're the ones who are sending remittances back. And they want to have family contact. They want to be able to stay in touch with their families, call them on the phone, go visit them, send them remittances. And so that generation from about 1980 onward are much more open to an improvement in U.S.-Cuban relations. We're seeing right now, I think, two things are important in this regard. The Cuban American National Foundation, founded in the 1980s, was for two decades the central voice of conservative Cuban Americans opposing any improvement in U.S.-Cuban relations, now has actually changed its position to a more moderate one of saying that there ought to be open family relations. They hosted a speech by Barack Obama in Miami in which he called for lifting all restrictions on travel by Cuban Americans and all restrictions on remittances by Cuban Americans. So that's a real turnaround in the community.
Mm. Well, obviously there in Washington, there would be a lot of people to be in a position to influence the American policy toward Cuba. There's the president, there's members of Congress, and then there are Americans who have at least have the opportunity to say what they think, if not exert some sort of influence. So if supposing that, say, a majority of Cuban Americans said, we think now it should be the policy of the United States to have normal relations with Cuba, given that still there, it does indeed matter who the president is and what the president thinks and what members of Congress think, how much weight would that kind of a change in the Cuban-American community carry?
Well, I think if you got to a point where a majority of the community was in favor of normal relations and it was a part of the community that was politically organized and was willing to vote on that basis and give political money on that basis, we'd have normal relations with Cuba in no time.
Mm-hmm.
That is still the principal obstacle to normal relations. Congress has been inclined to at least lift the travel embargo to allow people to travel freely to Cuba. They voted to do that 3 or 4 times during the Bush administration, but it never became law because the president always threatened to veto the legislation if it came to him with that provision in it. And so Republican leaders in Congress then would strip that provision out. So there's a predisposition, I think, in the Congress to relax some of the travel restrictions. There's a strong constituency in the Republican Midwest to open up commerce with Cuba, particularly because Cuba's a major purchaser of agricultural goods, and so they'd like to see a more open commercial relationship with Cuba. So there are some political forces, countervailing forces, if you will, to the more conservative wing of the Cuban-American community.
What's the justification, or what has the justification been for saying to Americans that you can't go to New York or Miami and get on a plane and fly to Havana?
Well, the rationale is that by traveling to Cuba and spending money there, you are providing financial support to the Cuban regime, which is an enemy of the United States, and therefore you would be in violation of the Trading with the Enemies Act. The embargo dates all the way back to the Kennedy administration, to 1961 or 62, when it was first imposed. Jimmy Carter lifted it in 1977 when he became president, and it was reimposed by Ronald Reagan in 1981, and it's been in place ever since.
We have another caller here bringing into the conversation, somebody in Champaign. This is line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I'd like to have you go into talk about their outreach program in terms of doctors, and you want to tell about that program and the impact of that program?
Sure. The Cubans for, I would say at least the last several decades, have had a foreign aid program in which they send doctors, but not exclusively doctors, actually. They send teachers very often as well, to other third world countries. Now, sometimes they do it as trade. In other words, right now, for example, there are something like 10,000 Cuban doctors serving in Venezuela, and in exchange for that, Venezuela provides petroleum at below market prices to Cuba. But in African countries, for example, countries that don't have petroleum resources, the Cubans provide the assistance by sending their medical personnel there, and they do it for free. It's, from their point of view, they're trying to build goodwill. It's their equivalent of the Peace Corps in the United States. Cubans have always seen themselves as having a global reach in terms of their foreign policy, and they've always felt a close identification with other third world countries and have always been willing to provide assistance, you know, within their means, obviously, to third world countries that were friendly to them and poorer than they are.
How big is it then, or, you know, to what extent, you know?
Well, as I say, there are something like 10,000 Cuban doctors in Venezuela today. Now, in most of their missions, it's, you know, a few hundred people rather than thousands and thousands. The situation in Venezuela actually has created some public concern in Cuba because so many doctors have gone to Venezuela, they begin to not have as many as they used to have in Cuba itself, and so people going to their local neighborhood clinic for a checkup are finding it's harder to get an appointment than it used to be.
And their medical system certainly is all free in Cuba, you know.
Oh yes, the medical system is entirely free, as is the educational system. If you look at the few public opinion polls, that independent public opinion polls that have been taken in Cuba in the last decade or so, one of the things that comes across very strongly is that the public is very supportive and very proud of the fact that there's free and universal access to both health care and education.
See, maybe that's why the U.S. is against them. I'm just, it's a joke, you know. They have a good medical system. Okay, thank you.
All right. Other questions, comments are certainly welcome. 333-9455. That's the number for Champaign-Urbana, here where we are. Also, we have a toll-free line. So if you're listening around Illinois and Indiana over the air or across the country on the Internet, whatever way you're listening, you use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. And our guest for this hour of Focus 580 is Professor William Leo Grand. He's the Dean of the School of Public Affairs at American University in Washington, D.C. He is a specialist in Latin American politics and in U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America. It seems that over time that one of the things that we hear is that there's, in a certain way, there always has been on the part of the Cuban people, a very strong feeling about Cuba, a very strong kind of nationalism, particularly when it comes to the United States, and support for their government and support for their style of leadership. At the same time, I'm sure that there are ways in which the Cuban people would think that maybe some things could be changed for the better and their daily lives might improve. What, to the extent that you can say, what do you think that the Cuban people would like to see their government do, or perhaps in, or would there be some significant changes in the way things run in Cuba that that people would say they would support?
Well, there's no question that ordinary Cubans would like to see a more open economy, and they would like to have more economic liberty themselves. In other words, more space for them to exercise their own individual entrepreneurship. I mean, Cubans are very entrepreneurial people, and you can see that by the achievements of the Cubans who came to Miami and really built modern Miami into what it is today. Cubans, you know, survived the what they call the special period, the period after the collapse of the Soviet Union, by being just incredibly, you know, clever and entrepreneurial about, you know, how they put together the daily necessities of existence. And there's there, as I say, a couple of opinion polls that were done by Gallup International over the last couple of years have asked some of these questions, and that's one of the things that that Cubans have been strongest in terms of expressing a desire to, you know, have an opportunity to use their own creativity and entrepreneurship to improve their standard of living.
Mm. Well, I'm sure that that already happens. There is already a kind of a gray economy that's going on, sort of an unofficial one that goes on all the time, every day, in addition to the one that's the more public, open economy. So do people think that somehow the things that they're doing and the ability for people to work for themselves ought to be at least raised up into the daylight, and that they think that somehow those two kinds of things can continue to exist side by side, but with the one being more open than it is now?
Well, that's exactly right. In the 1980s, the government legalized self-employment in a very wide number of occupational categories, but it imposes licensing requirements and really extortionate taxes on people who are self-employed. And the result of that is that the whole self-employed sector of the economy is sort of half underground and half not. You know, sometimes the taxation rates are so high that they actually make it impossible for people to stay in business. I'm thinking, for example, of you know, people who renting out rooms to tourists, for example, people who open small restaurants in their homes. And so those people then they give up the legal business, but they take the business underground and do it on an illegal basis. The government, by and large, has tolerated people operating on a technically illegal basis, partly because it realizes that it doesn't have sufficient employment opportunities to employ those people, so it's important that they're able to make a living on their own. And secondly, it doesn't really have the capacity to, you know, to put all these illegal operators out of business. One of the things Raul Castro has done in the last 2 years has actually, in a couple of areas, made what everybody knew was going on illegally legal, as a way of sort of bringing some of this informal sector into the sunlight, if you will.
Fidel was the leader of the country for a long time and still has considerable influence. Now his brother officially is president, but he is not a young man. We wish him well, but are people already starting to think about what about the sort of the next layer of leadership? And when it comes to the point when Raul is no longer president, then who is going to be running the country at that point?
Well, I think the leadership has thought about that, but I don't think ordinary Cubans are very focused on that. I was there just a few months ago, just before Raul was formally elected to be president in his own right, and the level of expectation for change among ordinary people was extraordinarily high. Everyone expected that Raúl had promised a number of changes. He had initiated some, and he had promised even more. And so there was a very high level of expectation that things were going to change and people's daily lives were going to get better. The leadership team right now is still fairly old at the very top. Between Raúl and his first vice president, his first vice president's actually older than he is. But there is a group of people that Fidel himself brought up through the ranks who are a generation, or in some cases two generations, younger than the founding generation that fought the revolution. And they're in very senior positions. The foreign minister's in his 40s. The chief economist, the manager of the economy, is in his 50s. So there is a group of people ready to step in when there's a complete generational transfer from the founding generation to the next generation, and they've been in their positions for a number of years, so they know how to run the government. Mm.
Are there in what sort of ways can Cuban people indicate their unhappiness with the government or government policy? Certainly, they do so at their peril if they do that in a public way. But no doubt, there are ways that people can do that.
Well, Cubans are notorious for complaining about things. I mean, they're not at all reluctant to complain about daily life, and particularly among people that they know and trust within their families. What will get them in trouble is if, in fact, they openly and aggressively criticize the government and the leadership of the government, and particularly the socialist character of the government, in a public way, or if they try to organize other people for that kind of a critique, then that puts them in the class of people that the government regards as dissidents, and they become subject to very serious harassment and arrest, and their life becomes very, very, very difficult. The mechanisms that people have to complain about things are the mechanisms that the government itself has created. You can complain to your local elected assembly person about things, and you can complain to the Communist Party about things. And if you're complaining about things that don't work right and ought to, or if you're complaining about corruption by local officials, then you might actually get some response to that. But if you're complaining about the fact that it's a socialist government and you wish it was capitalist, or that it's a one-party system and you wish it was a multi-party system, that obviously is not going to get you anywhere.
Mm. So there is absolutely no alternative to the ruling party?
No. No, it's a one-party system, and the government defends it aggressively as the right thing for Cuba, and there's no political alternative to it. And the only slight relaxation politically that we've seen since Raúl took over has been a slight reduction in the total number of people who are imprisoned for their political views. It's down to a little over 200 people now. But that doesn't mean that people aren't being harassed for political opposition. The current tactic seems to be to arrest them, hold them briefly, try to intimidate them, and then release them.
I think that some people, when they think about the future of Cuba and what might happen if relations were normalized between the two countries, and particularly if it was possible for Americans who wanted to go and do business there, that somehow would change the country for the worse. Now, I don't know, but I wonder, as you imagine that, when if you think about that day, when that day comes, when there are normal relations between the two countries, whether here's the way to ask the question. In what way do you think that would change the country? Or do you think that substantially, in significant ways, that would change the country?
Well, I think it would change it, but I think it would be gradual. In other words, I don't think if we lifted the embargo tomorrow and flooded Cuba with investment and U.S. tourists that suddenly the day after tomorrow it would emerge as a multi-party democracy. I mean, China is an example of a country that's opened up to the world, but the Communist Party still runs things and is still in control. I think opening to Cuba, though, will create a certain will create the social foundation, if you will, for demands from the citizenry for a more open politics. Certainly, the alternative strategy of cutting them off and isolating them and sort of walling them up behind behind a barrier has not worked. I mean, we've been doing that since the 1960s, and Cuba is not. You know, it hasn't become a democracy in 50 years. Hello?
Yes. Yep. I'm sorry, I know you had a little cough there. I wasn't sure if you were through.
I was.
Okay, good. We have about 5 minutes left. Just again, very quickly to introduce our guest, Dr. William Leo Grand. He is Dean of the School of Public Affairs at American University, Washington, D.C. He's a specialist in Latin American politics and in U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America. And we've been talking here this morning about Cuba. Someone has a question or a comment here. They can get in real quick. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, again, as we have talked, when we're talking about the possibility of change in Cuba and change in the relationship between Cuba and the United States, that I think we should expect that no matter what happens here in the coming presidential election in this country, that anything's going to happen really quick, that whatever happens, it sounds as if whatever happens, it's going to be a gradual change and it could take many years. But having said that, I don't and other than earlier you were talking about some of the comments that Senator Obama made in Florida speaking to Cuban Americans, is this particular issue, that is relations with Cuba and the United States, an issue that you think is significant? Or I suppose it's regionally significant when candidates go through Florida, but whether in terms of the big picture, I wonder just how significant it is.
Well, it really isn't. I mean, the only people in the country who are going to cast their presidential ballot based on the issue of Cuba are some Cuban Americans in South Florida and maybe some in New Jersey. For the rest of the country, you know, the issues are what you'd expect. It's the economy or it's the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, the one exception, I should say, is if there's some crisis that breaks out between now and the election that involves Cuba. You know, Jimmy Carter suffered enormously because in the summer before the election in 1980, you know, tens of thousands of Cubans came to the United States on boats and made it look like the president had lost control of the southern border of the United States. So there's no question that that had an important impact on the 1980 election. But unless you get a crisis of that magnitude, the issue of Cuba will be important in Florida. And Florida will be important in the election, but it's not going to be important beyond that.
Mm-hmm. So then we get beyond the election. I guess I wonder what happens with something like this, where this may be of extreme importance to a very small number of Americans, but to the rest of the country, as you say, you know, they got other things to worry about. And if nothing really big happens, if there is no big crisis, if nothing really happens to force a president to address that issue, then what is it that happens, or what is it that might happen to if we argue that having a more open and normal relationship between the two countries is constructive? I mean, if we say, okay, if that's a good thing, but if Cuba and Cuban American relations aren't all that high on the list, then what is it that happens to nudge? Kind of to nudge this thing along, if we say it's a good thing, if we nudge it in the direction of normalization.
Yeah. I think, well, one possibility is Congress. If the Congress comes back with at least as large a Democratic majority as it has now, which I think is likely, you will see some pressure from Congress, at least on the issue of the travel ban, if not on some of the commercial issues. You know, Senator Obama has said the past 50 years of U.S. policy have failed and we need to take another look at them. Now, he's also said he wants to maintain the embargo until there's democracy in Cuba. But the fact that he recognizes that the current policy has not been very successful suggests he's willing to take a new look at things. And finally, you know, Raul Castro has on three different occasions offered to open a dialogue with the United States to address issues in dispute between the two countries. I think his focus is on trying to improve his domestic economy, and therefore, if he can reduce the level of tension with the United States, that helps him in his domestic policy. So I think there's an opportunity for the next president, whether it's Obama or McCain, to open a dialogue with the Cubans. And you know, you're not going to resolve some of the big issues between the two countries overnight. You're just not. The issue of the embargo, the issue of Cuban compensation for the property they nationalized back in 1959 and 1960, the whole issue of, you know, the United States insisting Cuba has to be a democracy before we have a normal relationship. But there are a series of issues that we could be talking with the Cubans about that are in the interests of both countries. One is migration. We ought to have a better dialogue between the two countries to assure that migration is safe and legal, rather than having people taking off on rafts across the Florida Strait and running a 50% risk of drowning. Another is counter-narcotics. Cuba sits in the middle of the Caribbean and in the middle of the access routes that Colombian drug traffickers use to smuggle drugs into the United States. Because there's not much cooperation right now between Cuba and the United States, traffickers can hide out in Cuban waters before making the shot up to Florida, and there's nothing that the U.S. Coast Guard can really do about it. Another is counterterrorism. Because we don't have a real relationship with Cuba, it constitutes this big hole in the southern border security of the United States. And in the same way that drug traffickers can smuggle drugs in the same way that people smugglers can smuggle refugees in, terrorists could be smuggled into the United States through that hole as well. Not that the Cuban government would facilitate that, but the fact that we don't cooperate with the Cuban government leaves a hole in our border security. These are all things the Cubans have offered to talk with us about, and that we have an opportunity if we would just take it.
And just real quickly, unfortunately, not enough time for this, but Cuba, its foreign policy in regards to Latin America, has that, or do you expect that will change particularly?
No, I think their foreign policy is going to continue to be pretty much what it is. Right now, they have and are promoting normal commercial and diplomatic relations with all of Latin America because they see them and need them as trade partners. They have a good relationship with Hugo Chavez because there's a certain ideological affinity there. But right now, the Cuban focus is on their domestic situation more than the international one.
All right, there we will have to leave it. Our guest, William Leogrand, is Dean of the School of Public Affairs at American University in Washington, D.C. He specializes in Latin American politics and in U.S. foreign policy toward Latin America. Professor Leogrand, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
This program, Focus 580, made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering professional licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana. Since 1982, Bodywork Associates offers four area locations, including one on the lower level of the Illini Union at the Oasis. Coming up a little bit later today as part of the Afternoon Magazine, we'll get the inside story of a landmark case in the Supreme Court involving executive power and plans for military tribunals at Guantanamo Bay. Following the 1 o'clock news, Celeste Quinn will be talking with Jonathan Mahler. He is author of the book The Challenge, Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, and the Fight Over Presidential Power. That's coming up in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. Celeste Quinn is the host. Show gets underway at noon. Coming up in the next part of this program, we'll be talking about the subprime mortgage crisis. And our guest for that will be Matthew Padilla. He is a business reporter for the Orange County Register and is co-author of a recent book titled Chain of Blame, How Wall Street Caused the Mortgage and Credit Crisis. More on that in a bit. First, though, we'll break for an update on the news and markets. Stay tuned.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. We're at the Chicago Board of Trade. The beginnings of a recovery rally are underway, where we're seeing both in the corn and soybean pits new highs being made for the week, the technical charts turning upwards, and it looks like to me, as I look at the charts in soy for the lead month, the top of the rally now beginning to approach the 10-day moving average, While over on the corn chart in the lead month option, we're seeing that corn actually has moved above its 10-day moving average today. Let's go ahead and look at particulars in Kansas City. September wheat at 868, up 41. December 890, up 40 and 3 quarters. September wheat at the Board of Trade at 835 and a half, up 45 and a quarter. December 863 and a half, up 48 and a quarter. March 887, up 47 and a half. September corn 530, up 21. December 550, up 21 and a half. March at 569 and a half, up 21 and three quarters. May 580, up 21. August soybeans 1242, up 22. September 1260, up 52.